This is Transit Unplugged, and I'm your host, Paul Comfort. Welcome to a very special series. This is Transit Unplugged in the United Kingdom. I recently traveled to the United Kingdom for about a week and visited all over the country, found out the differences between the areas of Wales and Scotland and the England, all part of the United Kingdom. And our first guest today is Dave Pearson. Dave is the Director of Transport Services for West Yorkshire Combined Authority, headquartered in the city of Leeds, which was about a two-hour train ride north of London. Dave's a great guy, and he describes to me really the differences between how bus service particularly is run outside of London and how it's done here in North America. It's done very differently. There, private bus companies come in and basically decide the routes, the fares, and the schedules they think would be profitable for them to run, submit it to the transport commissioner. Once they get approval, they start this route. They don't really get any direct subsidy from the government. They do get reimbursed for elderly and disabled passengers. It's a very different model than what's done in North America. And then the transit authority oftentimes will commission certain bus routes to fill in the gaps that were not potentially profitable. At the West Yorkshire Combined Authority, about 20% of the routes are commissioned out to fill in those gaps. You'll hear all about it and how they run the rest of their service there as well on this special first edition of Transit Unplugged Travels to the United Kingdom. Hope you enjoy it and make sure you subscribe to the series at our website, transitunplugged.com, to get each of these new special episodes coming one every week in our Transit Unplugged special series where we're now reaching internationally. Hope you enjoy. Thank you.
What does it mean to be a successful public transit agency? What are you doing to lead the way? It's time to learn from the top transit professionals in North America. This is Transit Unplugged with your host, Paul Comfort.
I'm Paul Comfort, and welcome to a special edition of Transit Unplugged. Today, I'm in Leeds, in the United Kingdom, speaking with Dave Pearson, who is Director of Transport Services for the West Yorkshire Combined Authority. Dave, thanks for having me into your office today.
You're absolutely welcome.
Thank you for coming. Great to be here. You're the first of the interviews I'm doing here in England, at least six interviews we're doing across the United Kingdom. Tell us a little bit about maybe yourself and how you ended up becoming the head here. Here in the UK, you call yourself directors and managing directors, but you're basically the CEO, right?
Of the transport side of this organization.
Yes.
The Combined Authority brings together transport and economic development for our region. And so I'm sort of leading on the transport side of that. We sort of do it as a collaborative approach. So we cover things like inward investment and business support and things like that, which my colleagues work on, because we think it's very important that transport and transit are managed alongside the economy. And so as we develop the city and develop the region, we need to develop our transport alongside it.
That's wonderful. I strongly believe that. Transport is a big part of economic development. So the agency itself, is this your government agency run by the county or the state? What is this considered?
We are what in UK terms is local government. So essentially our governance is by elected local representatives. And West Yorkshire is a conurbation, a city region. So as well as the city of Leeds, which where we're in today, which is the primary city in the region, we have Bradford, which is another large city in the UK, as a sort of neighbouring city, and we have Huddersfield, Halifax, Wakefield, also fairly significant towns in the region. So we see ourselves very much as a regional body, and the governance of our body is elected local representatives.
Okay, so who are the executive director of your agency reports to, like the local government elected folks?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Gotcha.
Yes.
Very good. So how'd you end up here in this role? You've been here for a while, right?
I've been in this organization in its previous forms since 2002. I joined here as basically managing the bus and rail franchises contracts that we have. And I sort of moved a little bit through the organization. And then in 2013, this region, the Yorkshire region, hosted the first 2 days of the Tour de France, which is one of the biggest sporting events in the world. And so I was asked to join the organization of doing that for 9 months. And that was quite an interesting challenge in the sense that we closed roads. We had over 5 million people come and often to fairly remote locations mm-hmm. to come and watch the event. So fortunately, it was a very successful event, but it was a great experience for me. And following that, I moved into this role when that finished. So that's my history to get to here.
And tell us about your role. What do you do in your role? What do you oversee, a little bit about the agency and that kind of stuff?
Okay. I think the first thing people who are listening to this probably need to grasp in terms of how transit works outside of London in the UK, because there is a difference between how yes. it works in London and how it works outside okay. of London.
And you're about 2 hours north of London.
We are. Yes. So how it works outside of London is that the Public Transport Authority, ourselves, we don't actually run trains or buses. We're not an operator of services. We're essentially a commissioner of services. And if we take rail first, then rail operates on a number of franchises which are let by the national government. But we do have a body in the north of England, which we work closely with, where some of that franchise management is devolved out so that we can have a much more local feel to managing it. But at the end of the day, rail franchising is done by central government. Okay. Central government run a competitive process, appoint train companies to operate the local franchises. So the franchise environment for rail in the UK, there are some intercity, as we call them, linking all the major city and major regions.
Which I just wrote here. London,
which you would have yeah. used to get here. And then there's some local franchises. And in our region, it's the northern, because we're the north of England, the northern franchise. And then we have something called Transpennine Express. And that Transpennine Express essentially links the key cities in the north of England together.
Okay.
So that's how rail works. I think it's fair to say that rail in the UK suffered from quite a lot of lack of investment over quite a period of time. And whilst investment is now being made in the rail network and has been for the last 5 years or so, we're sort of coming out of that investment, and yet we're having very strong patronage growth. And in some respects, our challenge on the rail side is that our trains aren't big enough for the people that want to carry. And the patronage growth is particularly commuting into major cities like Leeds from the surrounding area. We are due to see some bigger and longer, newer trains over the next 12 months or so, and they can't come soon enough as far as we're concerned. Yeah. So a lot of my role is liaising with rail companies and with national government in terms of rail.
Who are some of the companies that operate those?
The local franchise in the north of England is the northern franchise, and that's run essentially by Arriva.
Oh, sure.
And Arriva are owned by Deutsche Bahn.
Okay.
One of the notable features that people will always comment about the UK public transport market is that whilst it is deregulated and there isn't a state-run operation, many of the companies that run it are actually state-owned companies
okay, yeah.
From Europe. So Deutsche right. Bahn, Abellio is the Dutch National Railway Company, et cetera, et cetera. So,
okay.
So Deutsche Bahn and Arriva run the northern franchise. The Transpennine franchise is owned or run by First Group, mm-hmm. And I'm sure you in the US know First Group.
Yes.
And First Group are also our predominant local bus operator in this region as well.
I'm meeting with Giles Fernley later this week.
Are you? Okay, yes, right. Yeah. Give him my regards.
I will, yeah.
Yes, because First Group actually on the bus side see our region as one that they're investing quite strongly in. And we'll come to bus in a second. But,
okay, yeah.
But yes, so First Group run the Transpennine Express franchise, and nationally the London North Eastern Railway franchise is actually under a sort of a light-touch government management at the moment.
Okay.
Because I think there's quite a lot of issues around rail franchising in the UK. There is currently a live review of rail franchising in the UK called the Williams Review. We're expecting that to report towards the end of 2019. And that is looking at the structure of the industry and the rail service in the UK, because I think it's fairly well accepted now that there are some structural failures in the way in which the rail service works in the UK that need to be addressed. We have Network Rail, which is a government-owned body mm-hmm. that manages the track and train, and then we have private companies let on franchises to run the rail services. And I think there's tensions in the way in which that system works. And whilst I think there's been a lot of attempt to address those in recent years, there's probably a need to rethink the whole sort of process. So that's something that's live in the UK at the moment.
Interesting, yeah.
One of the reasons why I'm heading down to London later on today is to support our feeding into that review process.
Oh, okay,
as well.
Very good.
So that's
rail.
That's rail.
Now tell us about bus.
In terms of bus, I mean, for this region, because we don't have any trams or light rail services in our region. There are in other cities in the north of England, but not in our region. So bus is very, very important to the Leeds City region, to West Yorkshire. And so, because predominantly our rail network, local rail network, is our mass transit system, but bus is basically the public transport service of necessity, really, in our regions.
Tell us about the population. We didn't get into that. Like, what's the population of Leeds and then the whole West Yorkshire that you're serving?
Leeds is around 250,000.
Okay.
And our region is about 500,000.
So, okay.
So that's...
Just so people get some context about what you're going to say. Okay, sorry, go ahead.
And so just to touch on how bus works outside London in the UK.
Yes.
Bus is a totally deregulated environment. So
this is what I find very interesting.
Yes, and the history of that goes back quite a lot of decades now.
Is that Maggie Thatcher?
It was Maggie Thatcher, yes. And that sort of desire to basically move transit generally out of public management into private. I think it's fairly established now that what aspirations were held there in terms of a market-driven approach haven't really come to fruition. And so what we saw in the history of that was that local government-owned bus companies were basically bought out largely by management buyout arrangements, and some smaller independent bus operators started up and operated. And then by a process, then there was consolidation amongst some of the larger management buyouts into the major groups we see now, which are our First Group, Stagecoach, Arriva again, owned by Deutsche Bahn now, Transdev, owned by French interests, and Go Ahead, and some of the other companies.
Is Keolis over here?
And Keolis have had interest in bus as well. And so we found an environment where there was consolidation of those management buyouts into big privately owned groups.
Yeah, multinational corporations,
exactly,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So how does that play out here? What does it look like to have unregulated buses? Because it's very unusual for North America. You know?
What does it look like? I guess it's colourful in a one way, because you've got lots of different liveries and you've got lots of different brand images and you've got quite a lot of different variations in the service. There is an argument that says that actually, unlike London, where all the buses are red, outside London they aren't. Does that give the simplicity of customer offer that a more universal approach requires? And I'll come back to that point a little bit. But essentially, 80%-ish across the UK of bus services run completely on a commercial basis. So the bus operators decide what to charge in terms of fares. The bus operators decide where to run and how often, in the frequency, and they invest in the vehicles, etc., etc. So essentially, a majority of the bus service is in private hands to be determined by the market. In reality, that doesn't create a turbulent environment for bus services, in a sense that the popular routes are the popular routes and they don't change that heavily. It does create a situation where the more marginal routes are sometimes under threat, and that's been a bit of an issue in the UK. So that's 80% of the services. The remaining 20% are commissioned by organisations like our own. So we have a procurement process where we procure the services. And sometimes those are entire services, and we run a full procurement service and process and appoint the appropriate operator to run them. And sometimes we pay commercial bus operators to run at times of the day or week that wouldn't otherwise be commercial, or to extend routes into areas where they wouldn't have.
You're filling the gaps.
So we fill the gaps.
Yeah.
Yes.
And in the public, in the side where these public company, I'm sorry, these private companies are running the service. Yeah. How do they get paid? Do you pay them any money, or it's just off the fares?
Right. Okay. That's a good question, because in what I've just described sounds quite straightforward and simple, but this is where the complexity comes.
Okay.
Because whilst the private bus companies income is predominantly fares that they charge the customers, then we have in the UK a system where seniors and people with disabilities have free travel.
Okay.
And so organisations such as ours manage a scheme which basically reimburses the bus companies for carrying people free. And that's that in this organisation is, in terms of our operating spend, that's our biggest area of spend. So,
okay.
So there's quite a lot of public money goes into private bus companies through the concessionary fare schemes, and we run schemes for younger people as well in our region. There's also a government grant scheme, which is essentially called Bus Services Operators Grant, which is, it started life as reimbursing bus companies for the fuel duty that they use. So there's a number of levels of public money going into providing a private bus service in that sense. And then obviously there's what we commission in terms of our contracted services. So broadly, it's about a 60-40 split. It changes in different regions, and more rural regions, it's probably more publicly funded than in a big urban regions like ourselves. So whilst they are private companies running buses, a lot of public money actually supports what they do.
Yes.
And I think one of the like issues we would have around that is that that doesn't necessarily give it quite the level of leverage that you might like in terms of being able to influence a service, which leads us to, so what's the ideal model that we would want to adopt? A couple of years ago, the national government brought out some new legislation which allows for more formal partnerships between the public bodies like ourselves and bus companies. And so we are sort of working with that partnership legislation. It also allows for a form of franchising to some authorities where they have some the financial flexibilities of an authority with a mayor. A mayor can actually adopt a franchising approach, but none have yet. Some are looking at it. We are adopting a partnership approach. So when you meet Giles Fernley later, Giles will give his perspective on that. But what we're trying to do is we're creating what we call a bus alliance, where we basically say the public sector has these objectives, social, economic objectives, spatial objectives, that sort of thing. These are the things we want to see out of the bus service. We want the bus service to grow. We've set some ambitious targets to increase patronage. So this is what we're going to do, and this is the infrastructure investment we're going to make, and we're making a lot of infrastructure investment, particularly here in the city of Leeds, in bus services, and this is what we want you to do as bus operators in terms of bringing new vehicles into the fleet, in terms of modernising your payment schemes and that sort of thing. Another thing we do in this organisation, just across that piece, just to finish on it, is we run a multimodal, multi-operator ticketing scheme. And we manage that by setting up a joint venture company between us and the bus companies and rail companies. And I sit on the board of that joint venture company, along with my colleagues and as managing directors of the bus and rail companies. And that has a £32 million turnover, which is modest by national standards, but fairly strong by regional standards. And that creates what we call the M card, which is an ITSO, which is a ticketing standard in the UK, smart ticketing scheme. And we're looking at evolving that into something using contactless EMV bank cards and barcodes.
Like Shashi does in London. Used on any of the bus services, is that the idea?
Yeah. Okay. And the advantage of running a multimodal, multi-operator ticketing scheme is that we actually have a sort of it's a joint venture company, but it's also a way in which we can manage things together. So we can use some of the ticketing revenue to plow back into joint initiatives between us and bus operators. So I think we've got a basis under which we can manage within the sort of privatised, deregulated environment. And one of the things that I'm very keen to do, and we've done for the last 2 years or so, is to adopt a close working and an alliance approach between the managing directors of the bus companies and the politicians in our organisation and people like myself to basically have that sort of shared endeavour that a deregulated environment doesn't naturally create. You've got to create that for yourself.
Interesting. Wow, that's great. That's a really good primer on how it works here. Yeah. Let me just say back to you what I heard and tell me if this is fine. Right, because I want to make sure I got this. So outside of London, about 80% of bus service is completely privatized.
Yeah.
They make their money on fares, and then you subsidize elderly and disabled passengers, and then 20% of the service, you figure out where there's gaps, and you commission that, and you subsidize
it. That's it. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That's good. So do they have to, do these private companies have to file with the government kind of what their routes are going to be so that you can pull it all together and put it out there on, it looks like you had real-time signage. I'm not sure it was all working, but it was real-time like things out on the bus stops as I was walking in.
That's right, yes. Yeah. I mean, yes, the bus companies are, there's a regulator.
Okay.
We aren't the regulator. It's our body. There's a regulator called the Traffic Commissioner.
Okay.
And so bus companies have to comply with operating standards that the Traffic Commissioner imposes on them as part of their regulatory regime. And one of those obligations is that they've got to publish their routes, their frequencies and timetables in advance of running them. And then if they want to change them, they've got to publish in advance of changing them. So there, and if they don't keep to the what they've registered, as it were, then they are in trouble in terms of the regulatory regime. So that's a part of the process that actually commits companies to delivering what they say, if you like.
And how do you limit the number of companies or whatever? Could there be 10 companies coming in just setting up routes, or do you somehow limit that and say we only want two or three companies?
There's no regulation that does that. And in the very, very early days of deregulation, back in the 1980s, there was a proliferation of small buses in certain regions competing with each other. And that didn't last long.
They got bought up, right? Or went out of business?
Some of them were bought up, some of them gave up. In some respects, what we do have, a level of monopoly, I think, is fair to say. If you were to be a competition purist, you would probably say too much level of monopoly, but that's how it's played out. And in some respects, whilst the disadvantage is that it's probably something that your podcast has probably covered before, is the level of real competition that exists in a transit world against something that's managed and provided for. And I think that tension sort of plays out in our thing as well.
So it's funny, in the United States, we drive on the opposite side of the road than you do here. And in the United States, the exact opposite happened in bus service.
Yeah.
So most of the bus service was run by private companies until the 1970s. And then they went out of business, and the government took over all their routes. So it's like exactly the opposite of what happened here. Very interesting. Tell us about this award you won, Transport Team of the Year, the National Award in 2015. I mean, you've got a good grasp of what's happening, and you're doing a good job managing. So what did you do to get that?
Right, that was the Transport Team Award, so that's not me, that's everybody.
That's your team, right,
And that was for the Tour de France. Essentially, the Tour de France brought together all of the key people and players and organisations that manage transport across our region. So that's road, that's bus, that's rail. And it was quite an endeavour, because what we were doing is we were closing major roads for 8 hours.
Yes.
We were bringing spectators and visitors into the event during that time. But the other aspect of what we were doing, because the Tour de France is a road cycle race, we were actually, in closing those roads, we were actually providing the space for the sporting event at the same time.
Right, sure.
So it was curious sort of thing to do, because on the one hand, our work was very much driven by the sporting event and the requirements of the event, and on the other hand, we were managing both the spectators and the people who wanted to see the event, but also the fact that by closing roads, you were actually causing some local disruption to people, severing communities from one side to the other, as well as all the crowd safety management things we had to do. So that involved just about everybody in the transport world in the north of England, essentially. And so one of my roles was to sort of help coordinate that. So we felt that in recognition of the fact that for a weekend, but probably for the 6 months prior to that weekend, everybody working in transport and roads and public service across Yorkshire were actually working together as one team to deliver, not just to deliver an event, but to deliver something that was very special for this region and on the worldwide stage. So we collectively thought we should have a bit of recognition for that. So that recognition is for everybody.
That's wonderful. So we've taken some time to talk about the past and the present. Let's take the last 5 minutes of the show to talk about the future.
Sure.
What is coming for your service here? What do you see yourself being in the next 3 to 5 years? What new technologies, mobility as a service, autonomous vehicles, whatever else you've got coming?
Okay. I think it's easy to get carried away with technology and saying, well, technology will bring this, technology will bring that. It certainly has. And if you think about the way in which we all use our mobile devices to manage our lives, then absolutely. Yeah. And if you start from that point, then transport absolutely needs to allow people to manage their mobility through their phone. And I think that's basically how people expect the world to live. So that's the starting point, because we've got to start with what our customers and our public are expecting. And so to say, well, how do you bring the sort of level of consumer choice and consumer interaction, generally through mobile devices, into the transit world? And I think that's the thing we're working on at the moment. Okay. Mentioned earlier, we have extensive smart ticketing scheme, essentially that. And that's an asset, I think, in this environment, to evolve that into particularly looking at the way people pay for transit, and particularly developing account-based systems.
Yes.
Because I think what people want is that ability to say, well, I can blend the different ways in which I get around, and I can do that by having one customer relationship with one provider, and then I can buy through that provider different types of transport and different types of mobility. And so I think you start from what the customer wants, you start with what the customer's doing in their lives, and you say, how do you actually bring those choices into people? And I think the transport ticketing work we've already done is an asset and advantage, and we need to evolve that.
You're pulling all that together into an app? Is that what you're doing?
And then I think then we need to look in terms of how that app extends the offer. So you bring in car hire. Because I think the one of the key things in the short term in terms of looking to the future is we're beginning to see, and I think we'll see particularly in the next 5 years, a massive change in the way in which people buy mobility, but particularly they move away from car ownership to car leasing, to car hiring when I need it, to blending the use of a car with the use of transit, with the use of taxi type of vehicles. And so people will move away, and we're already seeing customer and social views in terms of the importance of car ownership. Somebody of dare I say my age and your age, the car was a major asset in their lives. Younger people, they see the benefit of driving, but they don't necessarily see the car as their status symbol, their aspirational symbol. And I think that's a key sort of social change that we need to work with. So I think mobility as a service is very much about, I think, customer-driven, providing customers offer. One of the things a public body like us should always remember, though, is that we need to make that as inclusive as possible. So we need to think about the people who don't engage that way, and particularly people who are challenged in terms of access to financial arrangements. So one of the things which we are looking at is how do we provide for such people as well, and linking in with things we call them credit unions in the UK, the arrangements that are there particularly for people who on low incomes with financial issues. So we've got to make sure we don't leave people behind with this. Then I think we get into demand responsive transport, and you know, we've already seen across the world how app driven taxis, yeah. I won't use the U word,
right.
other forms are available.
Right.
But at the end of the day, calling a door to door transport service via your mobile device is an established customer expectation. We need to work that into the offer, bearing in mind the fact that a proliferation of small A to B one-person vehicles is actually just going to add to traffic congestion. I think at the end of the day, we need to balance that with mass transit options, personal transit options, and get that balance right.
Right.
But personal transit options probably are something which we particularly need to develop in some of our more remote areas and some of the areas where it's not commercially viable to run a frequent bus service. And I think there are ways in which we would want to develop that sort of personalised transport in those areas. And some of that, you know, whilst we're a city region, we actually spill out into the Yorkshire Dales, and so we've got quite a lot of rural areas in our conurbation as well. We've got to think about what the solution is for people who live in hilly communities,
right.
And how this sort of technology could actually improve their mobility. Because one of the other things I think we see happening is that some of these solutions are commercially viable in urban areas, but not so commercially viable in rural areas. So to a certain extent, there's a real interesting challenge for the public sector in terms of where it intervenes in this. Because if we just took a step back and say, well, actually, we've seen how Google, how Uber, how other people have just come into the transit world and delivered their things without us doing anything. If we just sit back and let that happen, then that would be great for affluent urbanites who will benefit from all of those things, mm-hmm. because those are the target market those companies are going for, but it might not be as inclusive as we would like. So I think there's a real challenge for the public sector to choose its form of intervention in the right way, so that it A, benefits the wider population and it delivers some of the social and economic benefits which we're trying to address. So I think the challenge for us isn't necessarily to follow the wave of the latest technology. Our challenge for us is to actually sort of harness that technology to benefit a wider group of people, but also to identify the interaction points and intervention points along the way that shape this new offer in a way that benefits our sort of economy and benefits the people of our region. So I think that's the challenge for us, is not necessarily to be on the latest technology.
Right.
The challenge is to be shaping the use of that technology and how that benefits people.
I think it's a very thoughtful approach. That's excellent, the way you worded that. Mm. Well, Dave Pearson, thanks so much for being our guest today. I can see they got the right guy in charge here.
Okay.
You got a good handle on what you're doing now and a good pathway, I think, to the future to improve transit here in the UK.
Okay.
Thanks so much for having me here today.
And thank you for inviting me.
You've been listening to Transit Unplugged, powered by Trapeze Group. To stay up to date, subscribe on iTunes or Google Play, or join the conversation at transitunplugged.com. Thanks for listening.